Sorry, I have to disturb. I mean, very good discussion we have generated here. That's what we want to see. Actually, we have the discussion time after all the talks. Probably we can have a deeply discussion there. So thanks anyway. Our next speaker is Dr. Jizhong Zhou. Dr. Zhou is a presidential professor and director for the Institution for Environmental Genomics at the University of Oklahoma. He is also the adjunct senior scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Dr. Zhou is an international known leader in studying the functional genomics for environmental microbials. She is also the pioneer in developing genomic technologies for environmental studies, including GeoChip microarray. And she has received the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientist and Engineering in 2009 by the US President in White House. That's really a brilliant award. Also, the GeoChip technology has won the R&D 100 Award in this year. And Dr. Zhou will exactly talk about something happened below ground, about the microbial response to the rising CO2 in Biocon field. Thanks, Dr. Zhou.
Thanks, Dr. Xu and Dr. He. So it's a great pleasure I came here. I gave a talk last year in this meeting, but more focused on bioenergies. I don't need a talk because Dr. Wu will talk about this. So give a nice talk introduction about the CO2. So what I'm going to do is that, okay, switch. So I'm going to do that. You see, I will give you a brief introduction about the new technologies. I think this morning has one session about bipolar sequencing, is metagenomic tools. So I will give you a brief introduction about the new technologies, how to analyze communities, because just Dr. Wu highlights the chemistry, but I will more highlight the biology in the soil communities. So then I'll pick up one example, how to use these technologies to assess the community changes related to CO2. Also, if I have time, I will introduce another method, a new network approach, how to deal with large-scale metagenomics data. This is quite a new direction as in this field. So as you know this, so we face a lot of challenges, especially in the 21st centuries. So I put a few here. One is challenge that how to link genomics to ecology, because you know, genomics develop very quickly. How can we use genomic information to understand ecology? Secondly, say how do we link biodiversity to ecosystem functions? This is typically very difficult in ecology. So whether biodiversity is important or not, so really we need to have this. Another difficulty is that how to scale the information. Now we have genomics information, we have population information, we have information for ecosystems, biospheres. How to link them together? These are all big challenges. So especially difficult in microbial ecology. So you know this, many people do analyze communities. Really difficult because unlike plants and animals, you can count it. But you see, in microbial community is very difficult. So one is that very high diversity. Typically 1 gram of soil, you have 5,000 to 40,000 species. So then 99% cannot be cultured. So we have to rely on the molecular approaches. So people use a lot with like a PCR, DGGE, T-RIFs, but this all very slow, very tedious. So especially like since the 1990s, so the genomics technology came in on. So really, see, we is another revolution for microbial ecology studies. Now at this stage, so we can say that before we lack of data for analyzed communities. Now we're not lack of data. We have too much data. We don't know how to deal with. So this is more difficult than before. So we don't have data. So I will introduce one technology which we developed. Just like I mentioned, we are the pioneer in this field. We spent the last 10 years to develop this. Really, I think it's the only tool in the world to have this, try to link the function, the chemical structure to functions. So we called it, a few years ago, we called it GeoChip. We called it function gene array because we put the genes which involve the function. Functional process of ecosystems like nitrification, denitrification, like lignin aggregation, all the genes on a single chip. So now we call it GeoChip, so because it's easier to remember. The HSV geo means more geochemistry. We targeted this process. So HSV is a single microarray, so containing many lot of information. So if you know the field very well, there are a lot of other tools like sequencing or phylochip. Really compared to other sequence technologies, GeoChip really can tell you the functions. So I think this will be more important, more interesting, rather than tell you who are there, but this will tell you what the functions, what they're doing. I think this is more interesting. Also, you see, is the high resolution. We really can differentiate different species. So if you use parallel sequencing, do community sequence extents, so you generally get like a genus or species level resolutions. But you see, really difficult to get below this. So we can get a high level, sometimes we can get a strain level. Also is quantitative, because this, I think, this is very important for ecological studies or in any environmental studies. We need a quantitative data, so not a yes or no. So actually, GeoChip has received a lot of attention in this field. So we actually, like 2 years ago, Nature Press Office, they did a news release for these studies. Also, the U.S. has a big program, like a National Ecological Observatory Network called the NEON program. So they spend about one page describing the technologies, because this is the only technology available at that time to link structure to functions. Also, the National Academic Sciences, they have a metagenomics report. They also highlight this. Really is a unique tool for this. Also, this year, GeoChip win the R&D 100 awards. So I think this is a significant award, recognition. So we developed, just mentioned that we spent the last 10 years to do this. Still is a continued process right now. So we have GeoChip 3. We have GeoChip 2 before, built by the year or three. Now we have GeoChip 3, have many more genes. So you can see GeoChip has many more genes, like you see genes with antibiotic resistance. This could be very important for agriculture studies because you use a lot of antibiotics. Also, you see the carbon, nitrogen, all this. Currently, so we have about 50,000 genes. So now we have, so just give you some idea what's the kind of genes on the GeoChip. You can see here, these are these genes in order carbon degradation. So you have lignins, like a leap, like John Zach gave talk yesterday, he really focused on leap genes and like phenoxidase genes. So we have all genes there. So from libel carbon to recalcitrant carbon. Across all this entire range of carbon, soil organic matters. So also you see have carbon fixation gene there. So five different pathways. So we have four pathways there, but one pathway don't have much information. So we have methane. So just like Suji mentioned, for the rice field, it could be very important for methane dynamics. So methane, we have two or three genes there for some methane production and the methane generations. So also for nitrogen cycling, we have many genes on there. All the major processes there, like it's nitrification, denitrification, nitrification, nitrogen mineralizations, like UDS, all the process, we have all the genes there. So then you see phosphorus. This could be important also in terms of agriculture. So we have phosphorus, like organic phosphorus utilization, the inorganic phosphorus utilization. So then another process could be very important in terms of environmental sciences, like you see sulfur reduction. So we have sulfur reduction and the sulfide oxidation. So this SOX is involved sulfur oxidation. So many genes involve the metal resistance. So this a lot of genes are on this GeoChip. So like you see, this is about 12,000 gene sequences are there. So many genes involve organic contaminant degradation. So it's like over 10,000, more than 6,000 gene probes, about 18,000 genes. So really, it's very comprehensive. We can add anything you want. So that's very flexible. So then you see we have some genes related to bioenergies, like this is most important for bioreactors. So we also do a lot of bioreactor studies. So now you see we are designed GeoChip. We use GeoChip 3 intensively for many studies. Now we design GeoChip 4. So GeoChip, we have covered about 100,000 genes. So now we will switch the format. So we will use more like, we work with the company, use Nimigen or AgeNet, but we haven't decided which one we must do. So looks like it's, we can get very good hybridization with this Nimigen format. So this is still continue process. Okay, I think doing GeoChip, doing technology development is interesting, but not very fun. Okay. So I just more interested in how to use technologies to address real ecological questions. So I just list some examples of what we can use. We designed the GeoChip as a generic tool, so we can use for any system. So we're not designed for a specific system, for any system. So we use it for groundwaters. So we use it for soils, contaminated soil or not contaminated soil. So we use for hydrothermal vent, marine sediment, river sediment. Also we use for bioreactors. So also we use for bioleaching. So like we recover the mineral, copper and gold from the environment. So it's because we put everything on the chip. So it can be used for different systems. Looks like it works really well. So I will pick up one example, try to demonstrate whether metagenomics technologies can provide useful information in terms of biology. So I'm not there. Okay, so doing GeoChip now is really quick. So this is the process we do. We get the DNA from the environment. So then we do some amplification or not amplification. So then we do labeling. So then we do hybridization. So from this DNA extraction to data processing, this part may be 5 to 10% of work, but so 90% of work is data analysis and write the paper. So you know it's very difficult to write the paper, not the difficult to do the experiment. So I have many students, they have a lot of fun to the experiment, but they have difficulty to write the paper. So it's very, so just Suji mentioned this, he will mention this figure, how global change affects. So actually in this global change modeling, so you assume that carbon dioxide increase, so then temperature increase. So temperature increase will increase the decomposition of soil organic matter. So if soil organic decomposition increase, so then you can more carbon dioxide back to atmosphere. So this is a positive feedback. So as you know this, any system is a positive feedback, the system will be not stable. That's why we are so worried about this. So I think now this could be not true. So this link could be negative here, depends. So our argument is that depends on the microbial community. So which community is stimulated, and so could be positive, could be negative. So I will use some examples to demonstrate that this could be more important. I will skip this. So we have a project funded by NSF and the USDA. So this project is focused on examining the community diversity in the BICON site. BICON site means biodiversity and the carbon dioxide. So in this site, this is the Minnesota site. So this site is a very complex design. So the various nitrogen deposition, various CO2, new CO2, various species number. So we, at the beginning, altogether they have 296 plots, but we focus on the 24 plots. Each plot has 16 species under CO2, no CO2. So we have 12 samples from CO2, 12 samples from no CO2. So then you see we use the tools, we call omics tools to analyze communities. So one is we use a GeoChip. So from a GeoChip studies, you can see this. So the community diversity don't change. The enrichments don't change much. So we use GeoChip, like ambient CO2 and ambient CO2, no much differences. We also did use parallel sequencing. So used to sequence 16S genes. Also, it did not see the differences. So it looks like the CO2 does not affect the diversity of microbial communities, but it changes community structure a lot. So this slide shows the red one is all sample from CO2, and the green one all sample from no CO2. So you can see this, they separate very well. So it looks like it says the community changed, the community structure changed, although the community diversity don't change. Also, you see, we did a 4-5-4 sequencing. I just mentioned this. So you can see 4-5-4 sequence also separates them very well. So then we did a more like a statistical analysis, because all this like ordination technique just pick up, the only explain partial of variations. So then we use more statistical tools to do this. We use three statistical tools to do this. Looks like you see on the geochip, we use 2 years, year 5 sample, year 7 sample. Year 5 sample use geochip 2, and year 7 sample use geochip 3. But the looks like the results are very similar. So you can see with all three methods, very significant. The p value very significant. That means very different. So for the 4-5 sequencing, so with the species level, you can see very different. So the same thing is for this like genus level, but if one of them is not significant. Also, we did the T-reefs and the biolog, all this. Biolog don't show any differences because this is expected. So the T-reefs also get PFA also shows very significant difference. So this suggests that CO2 changes the community structure, but not the diversity. So based on GeoChip, you can look at the details. You can look at which genes are changed. So now shows here is the genes involved in carbon fixation. So now you can see the genes involved in carbon fixation are much more abundant under CO2 than the ambient CO2. So this could be a good sign, because if we have more carbon genes fixed genes present, that means potentially fix more carbon more dioxide. So the potential long term could be potentially reduces the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. But this is one observation. Also, you see, if we look at how the genes related to the carbon degradation genes changed. So from here, you can see this from liber carbon to recalcitrant carbon. So all the genes in the liber carbon increase a lot, very significant on the CO2, but not for the recalcitrant carbon. So this could also be good sign in terms of negative feedback, because you increase CO2, you will increase liber carbon input to the soil. So that means you will stimulate the soil community structure. But the nice thing is that they're not degraded or cell organic matters. So the recalcitrant carbon don't change. So this could be good sign in terms of feedback, because we're not changing this. This is because this still in the field is a lot of argument. So why this increase the decomposition of recalcitrant carbon? Because this is a critical issue in terms of carbon long-term feedback. Also, you see, look at the nitrogen cycling genes. So the nice thing is, you can see, we can see all the nitrogen cycling genes, every genes, we can see. So only the genes change it is the nitrogen fixation. So the NIFH genes increase a lot under CO2, but not under ambient CO2. But this also, in terms of long-term ecosystem dynamics, could be good, because generally, so ecosystem is nitrogen limited. If you have more nitrogen available, so that means you say your plant have higher photosynthesis. We stimulate the photosynthesis, then you stimulate more carbon fixation. So with the nitrogen fixation genes increase, so potentially increase nitrogen fixation. Actually, Kai did some studies when he get into my lab, so use the N15, so maybe nitrogen fixation differences. Looks like you can see this, so nitrogen fixation is higher at elevated CO2 than ambient CO2. So all these studies suggest that, increased CO2, maybe not necessarily so is cause of positive feedback. That means you stimulate the decomposition of soil organic matter. So potentially also could lead to negative feedback, depends which communities, which population you stimulated. So I think this could be, this still is an argument. So the hypothesis So now we're doing many other studies to try to demonstrate this. They could be not necessarily choose the first positive feedback. How much time I have?
3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay. I will spend 2 minutes to finish this. Okay, this part, okay. So I will just introduce a new fantastic technologies. Okay. So in ecology, generally, see, you only consider the information about the species number and the number of the abundance for each species. Okay, this all we do ecology, we do macroecology, we all do this. But really, you see, you got the interactions among different species. So that's why we all call like Shannon wave diversity, that's it. So now you see, we have a lot of information in macroecology, like the GeoGebra 4-5 sequencing. So really, we want to see whether we can develop new technologies to utilize the information to look at the interactions among different species. So we call this a molecular ecology network. So actually, we developed a method a few years ago. We developed a method based on the random magic theory. So we work with a theoretic physicist. Yeah, he's a quantitative physicist. So very good for this random magic theory approach. So we use this approach, develop the network approach methods. So then we use this approach to analyze all the sequence, all the data, what you have right now, 4-5-4 sequencing, and the GeoGebra, because this is a real challenge, have this data. So then we try to figure out the network, why the network changes, how response to different environmental conditions. So I just talk about this, we have 12 samples from ambient CO2 and 12 samples from no CO2. Okay, from elevated CO2. So we based on the 12 samples, we built a network. So then based on the another 12 samples, ambient CO2, we built network. You can see very nice network. So you can build network very nicely, looks like no problem. So you cannot get much information because too complex, okay. So we use some like mathematical approaches. We general module, like different module. So like so then the module means so the species or the populations interact more closely. So this we can get good modules. Also, you see more interesting is that you see want to see whether CO2 elevated CO2 will affect the community structure, community interactions. So you can see here under CO2. So you can see this is the based on the phyto chip data, phyto pattern sequence data. Under CO2, you see you have very complex community interactions. So we pick up 10 genes under CO2. You can see the interaction very complex. But the same species under no CO2, very simple. So looks like you see the interaction change a lot. Also, it's based on the function gene array, like GeoGebra. So we pick up 10 genes under CO2. And 10 genes, the same 10 genes under no CO2, no changes. So it's the interaction very simple. So you can look at, you see, like different groups, like this acetone bacteria. Looks like, you see, Don Zak mentioned yesterday, this group could be very important in terms of like lignin degradation genes. Looks like it's also more complex in CO2. So, but there's some other bacteria different. So this bacteria is less complex under CO2. So you can look at, you see, individual genes, like leaf edge genes. So you can see the leaf edge genes, the more complex under CO2 than ambient CO2. You can look at the individual genes, like this. We pick up a single genes, this uncultured leaf edge genes, very abundant. So it looks like a lot of interaction with others. But you see the same genes, so very few interactions with other bacteria. So actually, this kind of approach, so network approach, this is a new direction in this field. So to give you some additional tools, additional insights about the structure, we not look at only species number and then the abundance of each species. Really, we open you, give you insight about the interactions among different species. I think this could be more important than the species number. Okay, I will stop here. This is more supported by many DOE programs, also like NSF programs. So at least a few people are involved here, because actually many people, more people involved here. Okay, thanks for your attention.
Any question? Dr. Zhou, thank you for the nice presentation. And
My question, I'm wondering, because I really not in that field, maybe it's a layman question. We talk about the effect of the raised carbon dioxide on the microbial community structure. So I don't know how many soil types you cover. I wonder if soil type will be a factor for that kind of effect.
Yeah, I think soil types will be very critical for community composition. It's quite different. Different soils could be quite different, like clay, sandy, sandy soil, sealed, so it could be quite different. Yeah, the chemical structure will be very different.
So your conclusion that raised carbon dioxide will affect the carbon-related genes, but not the nitrogen-related genes, is that right?
Nitrogen-related factor to nitrogen fixation.
Okay.
Nitrogen fixation also increased.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And you have talking about the different gene data, and how about gene expression?
Okay, we recently did a message RNA, so with warming site. So those sites is kind of consistent with population abundance. So actually for GeoChip, so we can either do message RNA, either do DNA, depends, but you can get a good message RNA. To message RNA is very challenging, not so easy, very difficult.
You mentioned that you detected more carbon fixation genes.
Yeah.
And you detected it in microbial.
Yeah.
So how you build the connection between nitrogen fixation in plants and in microorganisms? You try to enforce it, it's good.
Okay, so nitrogen fixation, okay. Let's ask you a question. Actually, nobody look at the direct effect of CO2 to on soil. All people so indirect impact through plants. So actually, plants, so looks like a CO2 increase, especially in the Minnesota site. So maybe Kai can answer the question. Increase the concentration increase significantly. So then this could be increase the carbon fixation rate.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, based on the data we have,
okay.
Not the diversity.
Can you offer explanation?
Okay, the soil community is too complex. You have too many. You have too, actually, I think this, I would say that's why it's based on current techniques, okay? So, because soil community is too many species. You know, we only made about maybe like 10%. So you have 90% still not married. So it's based on current data suggests this, but I think if you exhaust your analysis, it could change it. But it depends on how deep you sequence.
What do you consider the best way to measure
people's diversity? I think it really depends on your ecological questions. Actually, I don't care about diversity, I more care about the impact. So I wanted, my goal is that I want to differentiate. So whether CO2 or any treatment has effect or not. So I want to differentiate this. I'm more proud to know if you can sequence maybe get 100 genes, you can see the differences. You achieve where you go. So you don't need to go do 10,000 sequences. So it depends on depends on the questions. If you look at the diversity issue per se, so then I think you need to use deep sequences. Now we did like for this 454, we only sequence about 2,000 sequences, that's it. So we can do deep, but the cost is more. So it really depends on your question.
Following the previous question, do you think the situation will happen in the next
many first sites, like Duke site, Oak Ridge site, Illinois site is like soy fest, also Wyoming site. Looks like we can see very clear effect, very clear impact. But we don't know whether they change a very similar trend or not, we don't know yet. But we can see the overall community quite different under CO2, new CO2. So like even with different soil depths, so looks like quite different. Yeah, we see the difference, yes.
Yeah, you have the last question. Yeah.
Actually, I know something the genes, they encode the amplification, something like that. The one strain usually in the DNA, they
Yeah.
So that means you probably have kind of uncertainty for your diversity analysis. You could not see the diversity difference, but you found the community difference here.
Okay, so the diversity, I think, you know, we talk about, you see, I just say in microbial college, people talk about species diversity, we more talk about gene diversity.
Yeah.
So maybe, yeah, you're right, because some is maybe the same gene from different species, from same species. So that's why we all talk about the gene diversity. So but sometimes we code, like you say, species diversity, we put the codes there, species diversity. No, we're not talking about species diversity.
So
soil,
yeah,
could be, yes. Yeah. So it depends. I think, you know, the one way you can do this, we haven't done this, you can, you see, get sample from many different soil types, then you may make soil chemistry. So then you can do partition. You can do like a statistical analysis, you can partition the variance, so to see which one contribute more. Yeah, so honestly, I'm not don't trust PFO very well. So I did, when I was with Jim Teej, like 10 years ago, I did like maybe 15 years ago. For the same strain, same bacteria, if we use under different physiological conditions, you get a different PFA. So it sometimes, you know, depends on what your questions. So I'm not trying to put too much emphasis on that part, because very sensitive, too sensitive. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So thanks, Dr. Zhou. Mm-hmm.